Welcome back to The Saga Continues, an official podcast companion to the Hulu series Wu-Tang Clan and American Saga. I'm your host, King Tech, and in this episode, I'm talking to the co-creator and the co-showrunner, Alex C. We get into growing up as a Wu-Tang fan and what it took to get the show to match his and the RZA's vision. Catch up with the show anytime on Hulu. You can catch a series over on Hulu and follow along with each episode. Let's get into this. This is The Saga Continues, where we discuss everything that happened in Wu-Tang and American Saga, now streaming on Hulu. I'm your host, King Tech, and today my guest is Alex C. I don't have a drum roll, bro. This is, I just bang the table for you, man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You're not going to charge me for that?
No, man. This is on the house, brother. This is on the house,
no
man.
No publishing.
Well, first of all, I want to say congratulations to you and the RZA for an incredible job, dude. Nobody thought that y'all could pull this off. This is something that was in a lot of people that love and grew up on hip-hop. We don't get opportunities like this. We don't get to see things like this. The last thing, I think, was probably Straight Outta Compton.
Right.
And that was, about 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
So, and then I was always wondering why after that came out, you know, nothing else came out. Like,
right.
What happened? Like, you know, it was so successful. And to me, NWA is, you know, pretty well-known group, pretty high up there. But I don't know if they were as big as Wu-Tang, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
To me, Wu-Tang right now sells out stadiums in Germany or whatever, man, you know. I was always wondering why nothing was happening with them. And then I heard about this series, and I heard you and RZA working together on this, man. And I was like to myself saying, as a hip-hop fan, I can't wait to see this. And then when I got the call from RZA to be a small part of this thing, I was very excited. And then I finally got to meet you, man. And I guess the main question is, what is your role exactly? And just out the bat, how did you hook up with RZA, and how did this all come about, man?
Yeah, well, I'm the co-creator and co-showrunner.
What is the showrunner for fans that don't know what the heck, man? Because I'm just barely learning that myself.
Yeah, I mean, it means that everything that has to do with the making of the show, from the writing to the costumes, you know, to the editing, you are in charge of. You literally are running the show. So me and RZA, because sometimes someone can create a show but not be the showrunner. Then they can hire someone because it's, you know, it is an insane job.
That means you handle everything?
Yeah, you oversee everything. Yeah, man, like, you know, which is a different job. I mean, it's a different skill set than I've had previously as a writer, because you're in charge of people now, you know, and you hire and fire people. You know what I mean? It's like having a company almost. Do you know what I mean?
Gotcha.
And to answer it, I mean, it wasn't the first question, but it's something that you were talking about, like, you know, after the success of Straight Outta Compton, you
right.
know, definitely people were trying to jump on that bandwagon. But I think it's a testament to how hard it is in Hollywood to put a project together and get the ball rolling. And, you know, all this stuff costs a lot of money. And so there's a lot of people that have a say on whether or not something gets greenlit or not. So it's incredibly difficult to get anything made, whether it be a movie or a TV series, right? This has existed, the Wu-Tang project, for a long time, you know, long before I met RZA. It was at Imagine. I think RZA had the first time he started his relationship with them was working on American Gangster as an actor. I think then he got to start to get to know Brian Grazer a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hired him as an actor to be one of the main casts on, I think the show's called Gang Related or
right
on
right,
Fox.
Yeah.
And then I think around that point, they were like, you know, we Imagine was interested in doing the Wu-Tang story. And I think RZA was really careful about who
right.
He was going to partner with. And then from there, Imagine, you know, they were aware of the kind of work that I do. And they brought me in for a meeting. And
what was the work you had done already? Like, what was your credentials?
Well, a lot of the work that maybe caught their attention are like scripts that never got made, you know, that I would have got paid to do. And, you know, because again, it's hard to make, but in terms of the credits that I had at that time, was I wrote Watchmen, one of the writers on Watchmen, which is a superhero movie. Right. I also wrote this thing called Sucker Free City that Spike Lee directed
for in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
By San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was for Showtime. That was originally meant to be a television series, but they didn't pick up the pilot, and they released the pilot as a movie. So
it was pretty cool, though. It was really nice, man. Great job on that. What was your role in that part? The writer.
I created it. Yeah, I wrote it. And if it had moved forward, perhaps I would have been the showrunner of that, or worked, or you know, I would have had to, because I was pretty young then. You know, but if it didn't move forward. Yeah, but gotcha. It would have been a similar role than gotcha. That I have now, and from that, they said, you know, do you like the Wu-Tang Clan? I'm like, yeah, I love the Wu-Tang Clan. Like, you know, well, we want to do this as a TV series. Would you be? And we're working with RZA. Would you be interested in meeting him? I'm like, for sure. Right. But you know, that doesn't mean you know that there's a TV series there. You know, right? Because you don't know everything about it, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not and TV series is much different than a movie, so. Him and I met at the Imagine offices. You know, I guess he liked me enough. And then we started just kind of spending time together and talking. And he had told me, you know, he told me just what the little that he told me made me believe that there is a TV series here, not a limited series, not like the story is so big that it was something that I believe could be told over multiple seasons.
So obviously you got great credentials talking to a cat like RZA who's putting his life story out there. Is there ever a dispute between you and him on how it should be portrayed or how it should come on, how it should be visualized, or how do you, I guess, resolve disputes with the RZA? How does that work?
Well,
it can't be easy.
I wouldn't call them disputes. I'd call them discussions, and we have them. But the great thing about RZA is, like, he's a great listener. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, he ain't a motherfucker that's just sitting there waiting to talk. The biggest thing I could say about him, and the thing that struck me, is like, okay, I think I can, you know, because I'd never really, there's one other person I've ever written a script with, but I don't normally do that, right? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, not only was it like, we're going to be partners, like, we're going to write a script together like that, you know? So right. It's like, all right, let's, I mean, honestly, I was like, I'm going to try this out, and if it's horrible, because we didn't know each other, I would just quit. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, really? Like, because I didn't know what the process, but we didn't know each other, do you know what I mean?
Right.
But like, he was as generous as I could have hoped for. I mean, the process was way better than I could have even imagined. And, you know, when we are seeing something different, and you can see why he could be the head of the Wu-Tang Clan and help kind of work with 9-10 very strong personalities, because he hears you out. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He hears you out, and they're usually whoever has the strongest opinion about something will win, right? You know what I mean? Like, if my opinion is super strong about something, he'll be like, okay. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
If his opinion is super stronger than mine, and when I say strong, I mean the passion of it. Like, no, I really think this. That person usually wins. And in the end of the day, though, I can say what I want. It's not the Alex C story. It is a story about Wu-Tang Clan. This is his life. This is their life. And, you know, all I can do is express myself. And at the end, and, you know, it's his life. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's it. You know? So the bottom line is, he's been great about, you know, when I say, like, have said, like, we need to kind of position it this way to make it more dramatic for television.
Right.
The great thing about RZA as a storyteller, as someone who's been an actor, who's composed, who's directed, like, he understands the Hollywood shit.
Right, you know? Yeah. Right. I mean, so my question to you is, I mean, you're working on one of the greatest rap groups of all time. You're telling their story, man. One of the questions I have for you is, what drew you originally to the Wu-Tang Clan? If you can go back in time, because remember, man, I know you're from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
I'm from the Bay Area. And in the early 90s, man, the sound was a lot cleaner, crisper. We were all, you know, bumping Dr. Dre. And then the Wu-Tang comes out with this dirty sound.
Yeah.
Do you recall your first memory of the first time you heard them, or did someone else push you on them? And the reason I say that is because their sound was so different coming to California, you know, being from Cali, being in the Bay Area. It wasn't a a quick, you know, like, I'm in love with this right now, right? Because I have to listen to it. I'm like, man, is this guy using a demo tape or what? Because it was like, static everywhere. Yeah. And it wasn't till, for me, till I got to New York, man, and I was, it was a, I think a club called The Fever in the South Bronx or something, and they played M-E-T-H-O-D, man, and the place went nuts. And I was like, and then I really listened to it, you know, and I'm like, yo, dude, this shit is dope.
Yeah.
You know, let's start paying attention to these guys, right? So for you, what was your experience? What was your first recollection?
Suspicion. Complete. I was just completely suspicious. I remember, you know, going to being, you know, at Lowell High School. There was a Tower Records at Stonestown, which I loved going to, and just looking at all the records.
Stonestown, man. If you're not from the Bay Area, man, that's like one of the hangouts in by San Francisco State University.
Yeah.
Go ahead, man. Continue.
I'd go there. I'd look at all the records. You know, and I remember the first time I saw, I don't know, was this the Protect Your Neck single? And it was like, I'm like, Wu-Tang Clan, what the fuck is this? Right? You know, seriously, I thought it was like, is it a joke? And, you know, I'm Chinese, right? Like, are they making fun of Chinese people? Is it Chinese people? Like, so it was immediate, like I don't know what the fuck this is, right? And then I kept seeing, you'd kind of hear, like, you'd see it in a magazine, right? But when you first see that album cover, like, you don't see their faces. So I'm like, I didn't know what they looked like.
Right.
And why the fuck are they calling themselves Wu-Tang Clan? I'm like, mad suspicious, right? And then I saw a picture of them, and I'm like, okay, it's a bunch of black dudes. And I'm like, why the fuck are they calling themselves Wu-Tang? Like, I wasn't super not fucking with it, right? Because I was just suspicious of, like, why they would do that.
Right.
But then I think there were, like, people at school that were, like, started talking about Wu-Tang, because like you were saying, we were like, it was Chronic, it was fucking Souls of Mischief,
right?
That's
right,
the shit. Right, it was Jay with the Damage. You know what I mean? Like, it was like that, right? I was like, all right, you know, let me give it a test spin. And so, like, for me, I would just buy singles, even if I didn't really hear the record. I would just buy the single and just fuck with it, right? So I bought the cassette maxi single of Cream.
Oh shit! Okay.
And to be honest, like, I hear Cream, it's like, all right, that's cool, right? You know what I mean? But what got me was the B-side, Mystery of Chess Boxing. When I first heard that beat, I'm like, what the fuck is this? Do you know what I mean? Like, what the fuck is this? And then there was like the Kung Fu sounds, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and and I was like, okay, like, this isn't, they're not, it's not a joke.
Right.
It's not a joke. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And then I heard Dirty, and I was just, I never heard anyone like that. I never heard anyone rap like that. And he wasn't interested. Is he rapping? Like, what the fuck is he doing? You know what I mean? And that is what got me. Chess Boxing is like, oh, I'm buying the album. I'm buying this fucking album. This shit is crazy. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
And even just like the way, like, the Emancipation, like, coming with that voice and talking about the Emancipation Proclamation and just like fucking the... It's just like that delivery with those lyrics was just like, wow. You know what I mean? Like, and that's why it was interesting. It was a way, you know, even when we pitched the show and you talk about NWA, because NWA changed my life, you know what I mean? In terms of when that record came out, I was like, my mind was blown.
Right.
But, you know, I'm a middle class Chinese kid from San Francisco. Like, there's only so much I could relate to on that.
Right.
But like, when you listen to the Wu lyrics, even though like you tell these motherfuckers are hard as fuck.
Right.
I could get their lyrics. I know the references. I know that Kung Fu movie. I know that comic book you're talking about. I know some of that shit, right? And so that's why I always say, like, there's an accessibility to Wu-Tang that a lot of the rap groups don't have, right? That's why their audience is super fucking diverse.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
So you have an interesting job, man. They decide if they're going to cut a scene in, take it in, take it out. I mean, and it sounded like you grew up with hip hop, man.
Yeah.
So, and one of the episodes, and we're talking about Bring the Pain is one of the heaviest hitters in hip hop history. And he has the SB 1200. He's working on it. If they come to you with a scene that they don't really like, the studios, and say, Alex, man, we don't know about this. You know, do you have to go to battle? Is it part of your gig to kind of confront the studios and go, listen, this is why this is important, this is why it needs to be in there, or is that someone else's job?
No, that's our job. And you know, and I would say this, we never in this this has been, you know, I've been doing this for like 14 years, and doing this show has been straight up, no fucking bullshit, has been the most creatively gratifying in my career, because usually the discussions you're talking about, they happen at the script phase. Like, that's in the script, right? And so, you know, if there's something that the studio or network, you don't want to talk about, usually that's the place to talk about it. You know, that's the first. And I wouldn't even call it battle, you will, because we didn't really have a lot of what I would call battles. It was always like the way Imagine does their notes is, to me, the right way of like how, you know, with the incredible team, Francie Calfo, James Seidman, everyone there. It's like, okay, so what's, when we write something, so like if we write that SP 1200 scene.
Right.
It, for example, which they never, you know, resisted or anything like that, but they'll look at the script and like, maybe they don't understand it. They're like, what's the intent of the scene? Right. Oh, gotcha. Make me understand what you're going for, because I'm not getting it. Right. And so then gotcha. It's like, okay, I understand the intent. Now you can say, I don't like the intent of the scene.
Right.
And then that's a discussion. Or it's like, I like the intent of your scene, but the intent of the scene is not landing on me. Right. And so then it's like, okay, if it's not landing on you, let's make that clear. Let's make the scene clear and all that stuff. So that's kind of how, in terms of the creative process of like, well, what happens if the studio and network don't agree with something? Like, the first place that happens is, you know, in the outline and script form. So they can see everything. It's like, you see what all the scenes are. We talk about what the scenes are. We talk about why the scenes are in there. And, you know, if you have a problem, let's talk.
And I asked RZA this also. Why Ashton Sanders as the RZA? Like, what he said, you know, he came in. And you guys just kind of stared at him. I was like freaking the dude out a little bit, man. Like, so did that happen, man? Like, what, why him as the RZA? And how do you decide on the characters, the actors? How do you decide?
Well, it's tough, right? It's sort of more than anything else. Like, can this person capture the spirit more than... do they resemble? Because, you know, you start looking for just people that resemble. That limits you. Right. And, you know, that's not going to carry you through multiple seasons. With Ashton, it was interesting. There was a, like, if you're around RZA, there's, like, kind of a quiet calm that he can exude. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And a sort of a peacefulness that he can exude. And when we met Ashton, we kind of felt that too, where it was kind of like, he was very, you know, you know, there was a calm energy about him. There was kind of a spiritual sense to him. Do you know what I mean? And he doesn't, I wouldn't say he looks like RZA, but then he's kind of like RZA was then, kind of like lanky, you know what I mean? And right. So we...
He kind of has that look.
Yeah. And so it was just kind of like, it was more of like a vibe, you know what I mean? And that was a really interesting vibe to catch. And, you know, and RZA, you know, you've been around him. He can kind of, you know, there's certainly other more energetic side of him too. But you know, there's the times where it's like, you know, he's in that Zen mode, and we kind of felt that when we met with Ashton.
So we just watched episode 2, man. Can you tell me some of your favorite scenes that I guess you guys visualized it, put in the script, and when it's finally shot and presented to you, were you actually there when they were shooting it?
Yeah, for 2, I was there for the whole time. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You saw them. So
yeah.
Let me ask you this: if it's not going the way it's supposed to, do you say, "Hey, hold on, stop, cut"?
Yeah. I mean, there's an etiquette to it. No, I would never. I would not yell cut over the director. Like, you have to, you know,
talk to the
director. Yeah, you know, and you hopefully you have great. And the director of this episode I love Norberto Barba. You know, we had a great relationship. You know, you communicate in prep, so right. You know what we need to do and what we got to do. And then, you know, during set, there's, you know, we talk about it. And if there's something, you know, that you want a different take, or like, you know, then you kind of, we kind of huddle off to the side and be like, hey, you know, what about this? And, you know, we talk. It's a whole process.
So but do you
like,
have a favorite scene in
episode 2? I love the hallway, little Africa. When they go in to the building, in terms of like, you know, from when me and RZA talked about it, and like he, you know, the place that he had referred to back in the day, with like walking down this hall and there's like all this weird shit happening in all these rooms, and then like, you know, when we were talking about that idea, I'm like, let's just run with that and make it even fucking crazier, right? and Bert filming that, like I love that. I love the animation sequences that they were done by Bento Box. I mean, that they were just fucking money, you know, in terms of, you know, we wanted to do something different than the usual kind of drug dealer montage, and also something that paid homage to kind of the pop culture references that Wu-Tang talks about, and you know, and some of the 70s aesthetic. And so we talked about you know, when I, you know, first discussed it with RZA, you know, I said, you know, I think, you know, we can do this differently, and we can do it like, you know, kind of like this movie called Fritz the Cat. And you know, he, and then we start talking about like RZA knew all, it's like, oh no, like you haven't seen, you know, RZA's like a cinephile, right? So he started referencing movies of this right. guy's that like I didn't even fucking know about it. And then, and you know, he was talking about a movie called Coonskin, and it was just like, oh shit, like, you know what I mean? Like, yes, that's, let's do it like that. Do you know what I mean?
So as a, I guess I'm a, I mean, you know, as a Wu-Tang
Bakshi, Ralph Bakshi, sorry. Oh
my as God. As a Wu-Tang fan, I gotta say, what was the one thing or a few things that you learned that, like, I guess the world would want to know, like, as you're doing this with them, you're like, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Like, for example, I didn't know there was, they were working on Bring the Pain that early. Right?
Yeah. I mean,
because when records come out, most people hear it and they're like, oh, this must have been made like, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago. Or they see a video, they're like, oh, this was shot yesterday. But it seemed like RZA had a catalog of music that got burned up in the fire or burned up in the building. And then he redid some. So when you were working with RZA, like, what was the most shocking thing you learned in the back? You couldn't tell him, but you were like, what?
Oh, you know, no, I could, we, you know, that's what's the great thing about relationship. And I appreciate about our relationship, we're pretty super open with each other. And, you know, if he doesn't want to talk about something, he'll just say so. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The first part, and this is when I knew this could be a show, like, I was stunned that I kind of just thought they were like all friends. No, yeah, I thought they were like, you know, just like homies, right? You know, like, all right, you know, social media, like, yeah, homies, right? Homies, you know, they're yeah. homies, and they do, and it's like, and it was just like, what? Like, they were not homies. They were not homies, and I was like, how the fuck did you do that, right? You know what I mean? So that was the first one where I was stuck, because, you know, I think I'm a fucking nerd, right? I think I'm a hip hop nerd, and I think I'm. Oh, I read all the Rolling Stone articles. I fucking read all this shit. So like, I fucking know a lot about Wu-Tang. I didn't know fucking shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. Like, oh shit. And truthfully, like, I'm, and I don't know if where we put Bring the Pain in the timeline is accurate, but it was done earlier than people think. And a lot of that music was, and even some of the rhymes that he would say, like, oh no, that we had this rhyme, you know, when we were like fucking 12. And I'm like, y'all motherfuckers were doing rhymes like that at 12, like, insane. Do you know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
You know, so it's stuff like that. And as a hip hop fucking nerd, it was a super treat for me to like be behind the curtain a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I gotta ask you, man, hip hop nerd or not, you know your stuff. In your top five groups, rap groups of all time, where do you put Wu-Tang? And who's your number 5, 4, 3, 2, 1?
I think Wu has got to be, when you consider the totality of it, Wu's got to be, I think Wu's the greatest. I think it's Wu-Tang, it's N.W.A.
2.
It's De La Soul.
3.
It is, can I say Hieroglyphics as a group?
Yeah, they're
like,
cool.
No, because that gets everybody.
Soulja Mischief was dope by themselves, but Hiero, just as a crew, was just ridiculous.
Yeah, so Hieroglyphics.
That's 4.
And then,
come on, think, man. Don't you?
I don't need to think. I'm just trying to
feel.
I want to know. I want to show super love, because I'm gonna say because they're definitely one of my favorite rap groups, and you know whether like it's. I would pick Tribe, but I'm gonna say a group from San Francisco that meant a lot to me, which is a group called Bored Stiff.
Okay, and you feel like as in a worldwide level,
I fucking love Bored Stiff. Like I will bump their shit now. The shit still holds up. I fucking love that group. I fucking love them. I mean, and I'm trying to be like, well, do I love them just because they're from San Francisco? No, because they were like a multi-ethnic group. at that time, you know, the what the fucking shit they were rapping about. Like, I could appreciate
get a pen right
yeah, go ahead.
Down.
Go ahead, man. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're fucking with me. Or is this
I'm not
real?
Fucking with you.
How you spell this,
I'm not.
Man?
Bored stiff. B-O-R-E-D. S-T-I-F-F.
All right, man. I got to look this shit up. Yeah. Man. This is his top five of all time. Yeah. Over Public Enemy.
If you want to look at how much, if you were just saying like how much I bumped their shit, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm going to play, when this is done, I'm going to fucking play you some of their shit.
So are we allowed to play music in a podcast? Because goddamn it, we may have to play this goddamn record.
No, we're not. But I'm going to play you, when we wrap this podcast up, I'm going to play you two records.
Man, many surprises coming from Alex C, man. I mean, I don't even know where to go from there. I'm like, he's just too bored still. I'm like, that's a crazy left turn, man.
Yeah.
I mean, but again, man, in conclusion, I want to ask you, what has it been like to put this whole project together, brother? Because, I mean, I barely know you. I've known you for like 6 months or less. And I'm kind of proud of what you guys have accomplished, man. Because when you watch these episodes, man, it's like I could finally have my 14-year-old son sit down and go, hey, man, you want to learn some shit about hip-hop? You think the shit you listen to now is just the way it is? Like, they're super dope? You have no idea what the fuck dope is. Like, sit down and it's amazing to see, like, the Wu-Tang shirts, the W, still being represented all around the world. I don't know, man. Just how do you feel like being a part of this thing and being a part of this movement, man? You know?
You know, I feel proud. I feel honored. I feel also, you know, I have a degree of concern, too. You know, because that's a
your
tremendous
concern. Is what? What is your concern?
You don't be that. This is to be given some of the keys to the castle. It's a tremendous responsibility that you are telling an important story, and you don't want to fuck it up. And especially having RZA as my partner, like I'm not trying to let that motherfucker down. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot more weight to it. I mean, to me, like if it was like telling whatever my fucking one of my own like stories, like I would feel like less, right? Because it's not, I don't have people's history in my hands, mm-hmm. and people's history, whose history meant a lot to me, right? You know, it's like if I fuck up my own shit, like that's my own shit. I can live with that. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's like more worse to fuck up. You know, right. It'd be more worse to fuck up anyone's shit. Like, you know, maybe work out, if I was doing the King Tech story, like that'd be worse for me to fuck up your shit, mm-hmm. but. You know, a group like that, you know, not just meant a lot to me, but it means a lot to a lot of fucking people all across the world. And if you don't do that shit right, then, bro, that's an L. Like, it wouldn't matter whatever the fuck I did after this. I could, you know, I could create motherfucking the next Star Wars. But if this is an L, like, I'll never shake it because it's someone else's shit. You know what I mean? It means so much. I'll never shake that L.
Well, I gotta tell you, man, from a Wu-Tang fan and someone who watches, you know, a lot of shows like The Wire, and I keep saying this, man, it feel like The Wire meets hip hop meets, you know, a lot of historical things that people don't know about. And like I said, I'm proud to say I'm a part of this, and I can sit down with my son and be like, look, man, you want to know how shit really was, or because the stuff, man, you hear these days. They keep everything out. It's very cleaned up.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know too much of the backstory. I tell you, my friend works at the biggest company in the world, which is between that company and Exxon. So you know what company it is, right? So they sat down with an upcoming artist, and they were like, hey, man, you sold a lot of units. Let's do a biopic. Let's do a series. So tell me where you started, how everything was, and who's, you know, influenced you in your neighborhood, and how everything came to be. And he was like, my mom got me a laptop, right? And then we started making beats, and then I made a hit. So what I'm saying is that, you know, like, it's not the same, man. Like,
yeah.
Now you can buy the beat for $50. Somebody can spit something funny on it, and if it's catchy enough, it's going to go. Where the time period you're doing with that was not going to happen with RZA and doing something funny and catchy, and it was going to take off in Staten Island. It was like, dude, kill or be killed in that era, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, it's really interesting, you know, and I don't want this to get twisted in any way that, like, you know, anyone's shitting on what modern hip hop has become. It's kind of interesting to see what you know, happens when you remove barriers of entry, right? Because sometimes that's great. It makes it more democratic. Like, motherfuckers just put this shit up on SoundCloud. Like, it don't cost you nothing. Like, there's no one to get in your way. You want to put your music out in the world? You put your music out in the world and see what the fuck happens. There's something incredible about that, right? You know what I mean? There's also a lot of fucking shit that gets, you know, there. And then there's also something, is there something beautiful about the struggle, right? You know what I mean? That, you know, it's great that there's no barriers of entry. You can be a teenager and have great music and have the world see it. But, you know, there's something about the fucking struggle to be, like, out in the fucking corner with your tape, CD, trying to even get to the point where you can make a tape and make a CD, have that shit press, hustle. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of, like, it's interesting because it's like a weeding out process, too.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, motherfuckers that aren't built for it, that don't want it, that don't love it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, it's so, I don't know. It's so I'm kind of torn on it, you know, you know, and that's not to be talking like I'm a fucking old fogey or like old fashioned or like, oh fuck, it's not that at all. It's just, it changed. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know if the change is good or bad, because it's like anything else, it's good or bad things, like anything else with the internet. Like, there's some great shit and there's some fucking horrible shit too.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, it's just interesting, like, you know, and it's not, I don't think it's just for me nostalgia of thinking back those times where, like, you know, you saw the fucking, the hustle.
Yeah.
Right. And this hustle now, it's just different. It's just different. I you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I interviewed Karis one time, and you hit it on the head, man. He goes, at that time, first thing you made, you let your boys in the basement hear it, and he got their approval. Yeah. Then the guys from down the block came in and got their approval.
Yeah.
Then you had to go down to, like, the 5-block radius and play your shit, and everyone was like, this shit is dope, right? Yeah. And then they're like, well, if you're that dope, jump on stage and perform tomorrow night at this high school thing. Then you jumped on and did that.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, one time I interviewed Naughty by Nature, and they said that, this is directly from them, man. They were like, dude, we kept going back and doing high school events, and that's why we figured out that our big hit records were always going to be the hip hop hooray ho, because if we can get a crowd into it,
right,
then when we perform these records, we can always have the, you know, the crowd anthems. And that's why they did, you know, with OPP, you know. So you're right, man. Part of the struggle of going through it and what Wu-Tang went through, and what especially what RZA went through, he was like, he was, even though he was failing in some parts, it was like data entry in his head, like, oh, not doing that again. Oh, I'm not messing with this dude. Oh, I like this dude. Oh, I'm not doing that. So that's one of the things that I learned watching this, was that he was like a mad genius even at his lowest point.
Yeah.
You know, and he was putting on the headphones and just like tuning everything out. They're like, you got to go do this. You got. And he's like, nah, I'll do that later. I'm a zoning on my music right now. And then I'm going to do the shit you want me to do.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm going to just give me 5 minutes. I just need some time to myself. And it felt like he had the vision of what was going to come years later. And I think, like, Pac had it, Biggie had it. There's a few people that were like, man, I kind of see where this can go.
Yeah.
But those were individuals. He was seeing it as a crew.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it. Like, if they didn't exist, you know, you could say, like, maybe someone would have tried to do that, right? But, like, it's cool, right? It's cool to see even whether some of this younger generation sees the clear connective tissue or not, right? But, like, would there be Odd Future without Wu-Tang, right? Mm-hmm. And even like I love Odd Future, but, like, I remember going to see one of their early shows and people were like, yo, you need to see this crew, Odd Future. This shit's crazy, right? And I was like, all right. So I went to go, I saw them at the fucking Echo, right? Right, before they blew. Mm-hmm. And even so, when they had a whole chant, they go, they had a whole fucking crew on stage. Motherfuckers were wearing, like, some motherfuckers were wearing, like, ski masks. So, like, that vibe started reminding me of that. And then they start going, Wolf, gang. And I just kept thinking, Wu-Tang, Wu-Tang. Yeah. And I was like, okay, but I think that's great. I thought it was fucking, they were super dope. And it's like, there's a fucking whole crew of them. You know, would there be a Brockhampton? You know, without, I mean, I was like, that shit's got like 15 motherfuckers. You know what I mean? Like, you know, would you have these kind of super super crews like that without Wu-Tang. And, you know, so I think no matter what, you see that influence. And I don't even know if those, you know, those the two crews I just mentioned are fans of Wu-Tang, but like you can see the correlation whether, you know, they see it or not. You know what I mean?
Okay, Alex,
which Wu-Tang Clan rapper in your mind is impossible to imitate lyrically? Which guy will never be duplicated, or it's almost impossible? Because, you know, MCs come out, they're like, I could study this guy's style. I could take a piece out of this. I could take a piece out. In your mind, who is the member that you feel like, damn, it's impossible to get this style cracking, man? Like, who's going to bite that guy's style? Because it's impossible to do. Do you feel like you have one? You have a name?
I have a name, but it's not like style in terms of like maybe how he raps, but just the mind of like what the fuck he's rapping about and how he. I think Ghost is really hard, right? And I think Ghost is really hard because not necessarily for his rhyme style, but just like the shit he says, you're just like, who the fuck would come up with that when he starts talking about like ZD and you know what I mean? You know, like you, even back then, it was kind of like. He would be the one where like, what the fuck is he talking about? Do you know what I mean? Like, what the fuck is he talking about? We're like, what the fuck is he talking about? You know what I mean? And so for that reason, I think he's the most difficult because of just like,
right.
Whatever the fuck's on his mind and his brain, just to kind of like, you know, he'd come with a certain style, but like, you're like, wait, what you know what I mean? Like, yeah. He's interesting shit. You know what I mean?
Especially, man, in this series, I got to tell you, man, his character is like, my favorite character, man. Just, yeah. I mean, I don't know how exactly it's on or not, but I think this series makes who's playing Ghost, by the way?
Sadiq Saunderson. Yeah, he's a young actor.
God, man. He's killing it.
Great kid.
Man.
Yeah.
He's killing it. He's yeah. So that's my, like, my dude right now. It's like, I feel like, I don't know if I should go hug the real Ghostface or the fake Ghostface.
Do it both, man. You know, hey.
You can hug everybody.
But you know what? It'll be like Wu-Tang, at least for me, for real. Like, so, you know, maybe these first few episodes, that's your dude. But then, you know, maybe it'll change.
Maybe it'll change.
It'll change, you know, like, because I've went through mad phases of, like, being super into this dude and then being super into this fucking, you know, then going through, like, you know, Inspector Deck is the fucking nicest. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Then it's like, well, wait a minute. I think Jizz is a nice. You know what I mean? And right. But that's what you need to have a dope crew. It can't be fucking obvious and just be like, oh, well, there's like really only two dope motherfuckers. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
No, they're all right. Dope and they all shine in their own different ways on different songs. Like, literally, all. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, the shit Master Killer is doing now is fucking, you know, he's fucking, to me, he's fucking killing it. You know what I mean? And so, you know, that's same thing with me for fucking Hiero. Hieroglyphics, it's like the same thing when, like, you know, Dell's dead, you know, Dell's the best. And I went through, like, well, Casual's kind of fucking smashing motherfuckers now.
Right.
Yeah, I went, like, I think fucking Pep Love is the best. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So, and if you don't have that dynamic, I don't think your crew can be great.
I thought about this the other day, man. The set. So, did RZA actually sit down with you and draw, like, his bedroom, the house, the location? Like, how did you guys even decide where to go shoot this thing? That did you see a pictures of his old house or apartment?
That is his old house. Where we shot the exterior of the house is his actual old house.
You're joking.
Nah, I mean, which is crazy, right? Think about that. Whoa. For a second. And not only that, we took the specs of his house because that's the exterior, right? But the interior we shoot on a stage, and we took the specs of the interior of his house and we built it.
What? That sounds so. Yeah. When you guys knocked on the door, that the whoever's house this was, what did y'all say?
You know, I wasn't there for that day. So as was told to me, you know, just explained like, hey, you know, do you know who used to live here? That guy over there, and we'd love to shoot here. And you know, they worked.
How much would it cost? Right.
I don't. I wasn't there that day, and I wasn't part of that negotiation. But you know, right. We ended up. I mean, you know, which is an amazing thing, right? You know, because we, you know, we shot in Staten Island. That's his.
Well,
house.
So in episode one, there's a scene where Raekwon's running with a Tech 9 or something at the door, the front door. Mm-hmm. Now, were the family members home and were they aware that this is being shot? Because
it's
someone running toward the house.
And like we said, this show is historical fiction, my friend. Historical fiction.
He's like, the kid wakes up. He's like, wait, wow, the car's from 1990. Why is there a guy running toward the house with a gun?
Yeah. Nah, everyone was forewarned. Yeah.
Forewarned, yes. Yeah. No, there was no heart attacks.
Yeah. Okay. No, none of that.
And then the other, my other question was, you know, there's a scene where they're listening to Cypress Hill, and they're like, are these guys from New York, Cali? Where the hell are these guys? Why Cypress Hill? Why did you guys put that in there?
Well, it was two for one. I think for me, I think it would be interesting to start populating some of the show with non-East Coast music, right? Mm. And I remember some of the reaction when Cypress came out was like, where are they? You couldn't tell where they're from necessarily, right? Because it was such kind of like a unique sound. Are they West Coast? Are they East Coast? Does it matter? And so that's why the character Jaw Sun's like, these guys are really from the West Coast? You know what I mean? It was kind of like a question because it's, right. You know, and in that way, it was kind of a little, I mean, not only does it work for the scene because of what they're there to do, which is to stalk Shaw. Right. So the song itself has a message, but to kind of open up their world a little bit. You know, and how music and hip hop can open up their world, and you know, it's a little subtle scene, but to change their perception.
Right.
Where are these people from? Huh? Do you know what I mean? Even like back in the day when, you know, one of my favorite rock groups, the Alcoholics, came out, like,
right,
hella people thought they were from the East Coast.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And it was like, nah, I'm from LA, right? So it's kind of, you know, and that's an interesting thing too when people, just think based on a sound, like, where these guys have to be from. And it's like, nah, man, you know, it's music, you know what I mean? But I always found those debates really interesting. It's like, well, does it matter if they're East Coast or West Coast? Like, you know what I mean? If you like it, right, you know, and what is that sound supposed to be? And can't that sound evolve? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's just kind of like, you know, and we wanted to show how our world can open up to music.
It was hard to you know, and hip hop was such a thing. I think it was to maintain it just inside New York. I think it was going to be impossible, man. I think if I can remember back to late 80s, early 90s, they were a little frustrated that it was actually leaving New York. Like, yeah. I went to Downstair Records. I went to whatever record stores there were at the time in New York in about 88. And I remember, man, they had this attitude like, hey, what is this NWA shit?
Yeah.
This ain't dope. I mean, it ain't New York dope, but it's Cali dope. Like, it's a different type of dope. They just were not willing to let the reins go. They were like, this is our shit.
Yeah.
And it even happened with DJing, man. They had this thing called New Music Seminar. I think there was a DJ battle. And I remember Joe Cooley went up against Cash Money, and Joe Cooley was from Cali, and Cash Money was from Philly. And people just outside of the East Coast thought that there was no way any West Coast DJ could get that close to them. And I'm telling you, man, if Cooley lost, which is debatable, depending on where you were from, it was so close, and he had brought in so many cool little things that, you know, nobody else had done, even though Cash Money was considered like the best at that time. So you're right, man, for putting Cypress in there. I mean, most people don't know it now because, you know, music is coming from, it could come from Sausalito to, you know, Pomona, yeah, to whatever. No, nobody cares now. It's like, if it's banging to them, it's banging. Nobody cares about regions. But at that time, your history mattered. Who you were down with mattered. Who was producing you mattered. Who you were, you know, who was your clique? Who you, I mean, it was very rare to even get a record deal if you didn't know nobody. Somebody had to walk you in, where now, you know, you put some shit out on YouTube like we talked about, and you get some credit immediately for something. So, you know, but you were asking me something about Serato earlier, man. What was we talking about DJing?
Yeah, well, because, you know, and I don't even remember, you know, we've talked a few times about stuff here and there, so I don't even remember what we were talking about in the podcast or I talked to you outside of this, but, you know, we were talking about the grind and the hustle. And
with DJ?
Well, just in kind of in general too, even an artist, of what you having to go through the struggle and what that brings, as opposed to how technology can make things so much easier. But is there something that gets lost in translation? So, like with Serato, it's great, and the fact that you have a laptop, like, you don't have to fucking bring no crates to you to a gig now, which I could totally understand. But is there something that gets lost in translation? I mean, and this is me asking you this. It's like, you know, to have to, I mean, I'm sure it's a luxury to have all your fucking music in a laptop, but you know, there's something to be said about, like, you had to choose what records you were going to bring to what gig you were going to do because you ain't carrying 10 crates of records.
Right. Right. And no, they're definitely, man. Listen, late 80s, early 90s, all the way to the late 90s, man. You like your record collection when you spun, it mattered. It showed off. Like for example, if when you go to karate school, they put a belt on you, and then when you walk into that karate school, like, oh, it's a yellow belt, you know? Oh, okay, so you expect a certain level of quality out of a yellow belt. It's not black belt material, but you're like, hey, this person can do what, you know. So the records you brought was your what level you were at in right. your DJing skill, right? So if you came on stage and you were spinning what everybody had, then they were like, oh, I probably just went to the store and bought that. Now you came on through on something that only the Mark the 45 King had, and you have.
Yeah,
you instantly were at a brown belt.
Right.
Now if you could do that 2, 3, 4 times in a row back to back, you got your black belt, man.
Right.
Now if you could like seriously scratch those records, put them in a certain order where everybody can dance or gig off of it or start screaming, then you had the black belt with the stripes.
Right.
Like you were the next level guy. So. I mean, that's definitely one part of it that I miss is that your record collection. I mean, it's look, man, if you can download everything I have tomorrow, then my 20 years of collecting records don't mean as much because you're like, I got your shit, you know.
Yeah.
So the other downside I thought it brought out early on, Serato, was, in my opinion, was that when you put your songs in, this is like we get into the geek head area now of DJing, but with this program, you can hit a button and it could put all your records in the right tempo for you. Like, so everything that's 70 BPMs, you know, beats per minute, everything that's 80 beats per minute, 81, 82, 80, right? So when people start first getting Serato, right, one night I'm listening to the radio and I'm not going to say the DJ's name. He threw on one hot record and then he went into the next record that was like from 1982, right? And I'm like, huh. It was a weird next selection. The next record, I think it was like Itching for a Scratch, right? Then he went from that to like something from Michael Jackson, right? So I'm like, this is like a really weird selection, man. Then all of a sudden, it was something from like a rock dude, right? So I'm like, what is happening, man? Like, why is he doing this?
Right.
Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, everyone's tuned him out by now, right?
Yeah.
And then I was talking to DJ Revolution one time, when if this is all in the early days of Serato, he goes, dude, you know what it is? It's in tempo order in his playlist. And he's literally playing the next thing he sees on his list.
That's so fucking crazy, bro.
So they were all tempo correct, but they were all different time periods of music and different genres.
Right.
And I was like, huh. So just because it could mix easily, he's just throwing it in. And they're all hit records.
Yeah.
But it's like, do you really want to hear AC/DC after Mary J. Blige? Like, do you?
Nah, you know what? I do now just to fucking see what that sounds like now. Just like I want to watch a car wreck. Now I want to see that.
I don't know, man. To me, I mean, there's definitely advantages to it, man. I know I went with Rev to France. The dude did an hour and a half set, probably played 80 joints.
Right.
An hour and a half, man. And he was tearing the club up till 3 a.m, 4 a.m. Nobody left. And Rev, man, when this shit is done, he ain't like the encore dude. He's like, oh, man, I can get paid for this. As he's, you know, packing up, I'm no joke, man. French cats are on front of the stage and they're going like pounding the stage.
Right.
And I'm looking at this dude, like if it was me, I'd be like, hey, thank you. I'm gonna open my laptop.
Yeah.
Red was like, no, man, let's go. His shit is packed, like he's got it on his back, like, tech, let's go.
Yeah.
And I'm like, bro, you got 500 people screaming your name. He's like, they see my name everywhere.
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's get back to the hotel. I gotta fly in fucking 2 hours. Let's go. Like, he don't care, man.
Oh, man.
It was awesome, man. That's it was funny. Awesome to see. And the other thing I saw was a lot of the U.S. You know, stars that we had, like Lords of the Underground, and other producers that you don't know where the hell they're at. They're in Europe,
right?
And they would come to this guy's show, literally, man, just pull up a camcorder, tape the whole thing,
right?
Just stand on stage. What's up, Rev? Hey, how you doing, man? Yeah. Just, you see 40 camcorders up in the air.
Yeah,
that's the level DJ Revolution took it to, man. Where he made it, you know. So much props to him, but. He takes DJing, you know, and again, I got when I talk about him, I always talk about Q-Bert, another Bay Area native.
Yeah.
Q took it to another level. Man, I was at his house when Ip Man 2 barely came out. He was showing me Ip Man 3.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, how did you get this, man?
Yeah.
So I watched the whole movie. It was like midnight. Now it's 2 in the morning. And this dude literally practiced. He sat on a stool,
mm-hmm.
videotaped himself, and practiced one type of scratching for 2 hours.
Right.
It was like, what are you doing, man? I mean, he's full sweat, then he went back and watched it.
Right.
And I'm like, dude, that's dedication beyond anything that I ever seen, man. Like, to practice one scratch for 2 hours and then go back and watch it. I'm like, hey, bro, it's like 3:30 in the morning. Can I just go to sleep, man? Yeah, yeah, Tech, go ahead, man. You go ahead.
Yeah.
And he stayed up till, so.
I mean, that's like, you know, in this episode we tried to capture, like, He didn't have the manual for the SP-1200.
Yes.
He had to stay up all night and figure that shit out. You know,
man.
What I mean? And it's that dedication, it's that struggle, you know, beautiful struggle of you know, and wanting greatness.
Yes,
you know
what I mean? All these people we're talking about are geniuses in their own way.
Yeah.
I mean, Q is definitely a genius in his own way. Rev
for sure.
is. And of course, RZA, man, I've been around him where there's like 50 different things are going on.
Yeah.
And he literally can figure out how to deal with all of it.
Yeah.
And I can't do it. Like,
yeah.
I was telling my wife one time, I was like, hey, man, the shit he does with, he's doing an interview, playing chess, shooting a movie, doing a painting at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, and his kids are screaming at him.
Yeah.
I'm like, yo, that's like, this dude could have been an astronaut, bro. Just would have been chilling in a space shuttle. Just like, hey, guys. Shit's blown up. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I already got the next shuttles coming in, and then we just gonna jump on that one and keep going.
Yeah.
So, anyway, man. Once again, man, I'm proud of what you brothers have done, man, and for the world of hip hop, it means the world because, man, somebody's finally telling not just the Wu-Tang story, but it's our story.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of hip hop heads never get to see and talk about, you know, or tell their family how they grew up, and this is it, man. This is. You know, unless you were on the streets running like N.W.A.,
you were
doing that, or you were in the streets doing the Wu-Tang type shit,
which
is that, like, you know, that's the other half of the world. So,
All
right, my man. Again,
you,
shaking
bro.
Your hand one more
Thank
time,
you. Thank
and
you, man.
We out of here, man. Till the next episode.
All right, man.
Peace.